Block Height and the Price. So you'll know we're actually live with the Block Height and the Price. So give me about 1 second and then we're go.
Oh yes, Daddy.
All right, everyone. This is Optimus Fields at My Living Truth, and we are back for another episode of Bitcoin Kindergarten. We're at block height 719,541. And the current price per Bitcoin is $41,940 per Bitcoin, which equals out to 2,384 sats per dollar. And of course, guys, tonight's episode is brought to you by Simply Bitcoin, simply the best Bitcoin-only news content on YouTube. If you're not watching Simply Bitcoin, you're simply not going to make it. Winikus, say what's up to the people before we introduce Phil and let him go ranting tonight.
What's up, everyone? I just had a weird shower thought. I think we have the best logo in all of Bitcoin, and the little honey badger should have its own name. And I was thinking Stackboy, the base badger. So just wanted to see what people thought about that name, or if anyone has a better one, to please comment below.
Stackboy the base badger. I might be able to work with that. We'll open source the name, but I like where this is going, Winikus.
Yeah, those are just my thoughts, but I think we have a pretty interesting episode coming up today, and maybe Phil can Fed pill people.
All right, without further ado, we got Phil Gibson at Mr. Sue on Twitter, and he's going to tell us all things bullish in regards to the Fed. So, Phil, I'm going to just give you the stage, and you can just go and let me know when you need some help guiding.
Sweet. First and foremost, I vote Steve as a name for the Badger, because Stackboy, like, is he a superhero or what? I don't know. And my second option is going to be Jerome or Jeremy, but Jerome in regards to our new favorite HODL daddy, Jerome Powell. Not really. Maybe. Who knows? But yeah, guys, thanks a lot for giving me this time to talk about this article I wrote. It is entitled Why Jerome Powell's Policies Are Bullish for Bitcoin. And I published that on Bitcoin Magazine January 2nd. And it really talks about exactly that. So I'll base this off of the three few points that you brought up, Optimus. So you had some points and questions that you wanted to go by as this flow for today's episode. And your first three points was how the Fed operates, 101. Give the context on how Jerome Powell is an unlikely ally to Bitcoin. Well, I think the thesis of the article I wrote might question that. It might be the opposite, but who really knows? And then what Powell's policies mean for Bitcoin. So all valid questions and concerns. How I'd like to kind of roll into this is really just give some background information, some context of what the actual problem is. And it goes beyond how the Fed works, and it goes beyond money printer go burr, which kind of makes me sound like a hypocrite because we just listened to my song and the Fed. And ultimately, it is the Fed's fault for the situation that we're in. They print money, and so now they got to deal with the problem after printing all that money, quote unquote, printing money. And we'll get into what printing money actually means. But it goes beyond how the Fed works. It's more of the question, why is the Fed doing what it's doing? And the answer is to protect the dollar. And what the Fed's doing is strengthening the dollar by removing liquidity from the world economy because the dollar is under threat. And we'll get into all of that. So I'll basically be explaining why the dollar is being threatened, how Powell protects it, and ultimately what a strong dollar is going to mean for Bitcoin. So let's roll into basically how the Fed works as we understand it, all right? And this is kind of what I opened up in the article. And even before I get you even deeper into this, I stand on the shoulders of giants. And that the main giant that was the main inspiration for this article is a guy named Tom Luongo. And he's a geopolitics macro guy. He does a newsletter for his patrons. After finding him on one of these podcasts, and he's also been on FedWatch, but after finding him, it just kind of like blew my mind and made me realize it's more than just money put to good birth. There's a lot of nuances in the world as far as geopolitics and why certain countries do what and why they make alliances together. And there's just a lot of different moving pieces. Ultimately, it is kind of like New World Order, One World Government, but there's even factions in between that where people disagree because they have different incentives. And ultimately, the enemy that's like threatening the Fed here is what Tom describes as Davos. And I believe if it was yesterday, there was a Davos meeting. They all these superpowers and elites meet at Davos in Europe. And, you know, these are all your World Economic Forum people, your central bankers, yada, yada. All these people in political power. And ultimately, Tom's thesis is that what Davos wants to do is, well, actually, I'm kind of putting words in his mouth, so I'll use my words. What Davos wants to do is a reverse Bretton Woods. And what I mean by that is that after, or towards the end of World War II, when they had the Bretton Woods Agreement, where they would basically peg all, like, the dollar was the world reserve currency, America became the economic superpower of the world because it was the last country that was decimated, or that wasn't, it was the only country that stood on its feet and wasn't decimated. And so the whole world like depended on it, and all economic activity just went to the dollar, and it's still the world reserve currency. Now you can argue with Triffin's dilemma, it's kind of losing that power, and there's going to be a day of reckoning because we're dependent on China and others. And the whole, like, Triffin dilemma argument, sure, that's there. But still, the dollar still remains the world reserve currency. There's actually more dollars in circulation, or really $100 bills in circulation, than there are singles, like single dollar bills. So there's more $100 bills in the entire world in all these countries than there are just single, like, dollar bills, y'all. Like, just throw them at strippers kind of thing, which is crazy. And I had Sam Callahan on my podcast, and he actually studied the BIS, the Bank of International Settlements, and he found that there has been an increase of cash. So, yes, we have a weak dollar, but it still is the strongest thing out there because everything is still settled in dollars. And you can argue, and these are valid arguments, and they're true, that you have Russia and China trying to move away from that. They left the Swiss system like a month ago. They said, basically, fuck you, West. And Davos, we're going our own way. We're going to make this financial infrastructure and trade with Russia, China, India, and everyone else because we don't want to deal with the sanctions and all that jazz. So that's kind of the background premise. And Davos is, there's Davos really everywhere because they're really just like wealthy elites. So you can think of neocons, neo-Nazis, just old European money, throwing the Rothschilds, whatever. The biggest, like, evil they that you can think of, they're probably in Davos. And what you have is Davos basically wanted to do a reverse Bretton Woods where Europe, the European Union, is now the economic superpower. And what they're doing is trying to make all these Build Back Better policies that threaten the Federal Reserve banking cartel. Because without the Fed, the way that we understand capitalism today would be upside down. So I am basically making the argument that Jerome Powell is basically strengthening the dollar and making people's debt more expensive, and all the investment in all these other countries are leaving these countries, and that is protecting the dollar, because ultimately what happened when these Build Back Better policies were passed by Davos, they pretty much threatened the hegemony that the banks had, because the banks are ultimately the shareholders of the Federal Reserve. That's how the Fed works. And they have access to the treasuries. So, I need a drink. Are there any questions so far? I'm sure there are, but as I take this sip of sparkling water, any thoughts yet, Optimus?
I'm following you so far, but I also listened to all that podcast stuff that you posted on the article. So I think I'm good, but I don't know, guys. Emoji check. Did you guys follow so far?
I'm going to see laughing, crying emojis, I'm sure. Okay. So let's just start with the basics of the Fed, and I'll just take this straight from my article. So the Fed's the lender of last resort, and the board wields the power, these powerful monetary weapons in its arsenal to basically combat any economic crisis. So when there's a crisis and they need bailouts, then the Fed provides that liquidity by lowering rates, because their ultimate tool is to lower rates. And yes, the market in the treasury market controls that, and it's the tail that wags the dog, as Greg Foss liked to say. That's true. But the Fed still has these tools. So if they lower rates to inject liquidity in the markets and to avoid an inflationary crisis, after printing said liquidity, the Fed simply increases the cost of borrowing by raising rates. So they have these tools of raising and lowering rates to put more dollars in circulation, and then to combat that inflation, they use deflation by raising rates. So pretty simple so far. And by raising rates, what that's doing, of course, is disincentivizing the velocity of money from flowing out of control in the greater economy, and things just don't get, we don't see that to just that deflationary catastrophe that we saw in the Great Depression. There we go. And so essentially there are a few tools that Powell is using at his disposal, and the two primary ones are that he's using to cause deflation are IOER, which stands for interest on excess reserves, and the reverse repo contracts. All right. And so Powell started doing this. He started drying up the markets way back in June by increasing those rates on interest on excess reserves and reverse repo by 5 basis points. And we'll get into all what that means. But it's not just like this recent scare that people were clamoring about in the past couple of weeks in the markets, like, oh, the Fed's going to raise rates. Oh, the Fed can't raise rates, blah, 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 blah. Well, they kind of started doing that, not directly, but they started doing that with these monetary policies way back in June, which made the euro kind of go into shock and a scare, like the euro dumped. And that's good for the U.S. and Powell, because he's ultimately trying to protect the dollar. And we'll get into how the dollar is being threatened. So really, how the Fed works is it's beholden to its shareholders of member banks. So your J.P. Morgan's, your Goldman Sachs, and also factoring all the 12 regionary Fed banks in the U.S., okay? And so this is where we're going to get into like what actual money printing is. So this cartel of banks that kind of make up the Fed are important because they buy all the excess supply of U.S. treasuries, treasury paper, so reserves. So the treasury auctions off these reserves, these U.S. treasury bills, and by the Treasury Department, and that's how they basically fund operations to keep the economy going. So this is what it means to monetize the debt. So these primary member banks basically scoop up 50% of the issued treasuries and then just immediately sell them to the Fed in exchange for cash. That's pretty much QE in a nutshell. And again, that's how debt is monetized. In contrast, like, that's 50%. So what about the other 50%? So foreign central banks make up 30, and then of the 3-year issuance of new supply of treasuries, so 3 years, paper treasuries. And then the remaining 20% is left to the private sector. All right. So therefore, when the banks are controlling, when that cartel of banks control the flow of capital, it's really the Fed that is controlling the overall, like, health of the world economy, because they have the dollar. It's the ruling currency of the world, and everybody's debt is due in dollars. And so that's essentially what's going on here. Now, let's get into the specifics of the monetary tools that the Fed has. So we talked about how money printing actually happens, quote unquote. And now we're going to get into the monetary tools. So the one I think that we're all most familiar is the Fed funds rate. And that's what the Fed uses to just manage the economy. And it's the Fed funds rate is basically the gross cost to borrow funds from the Fed. So the how expensive or non-expensive, depending on the preferential treatments that these member banks get from the Fed, what's the interest rate it is to borrow money to just take care of your overnight lending needs. And being the lender of last resort, the Fed can theoretically print unlimited amounts of money into the economy to these banks to help with time mismatches in money markets. So it's basically you have a stack of banks that lend money to each other, and if things go poorly, then they kind of go tits up, and that's kind of like we saw with Lehman, and we'll get into Lehman, but that's kind of what we saw in the GFC crisis of 2008 with mortgages and everything. And so basically the banks had IOUs to each other, and they all went like tits up. So that's where the Fed had to come in and bail them out. Except Lehman, of course, because they got fucked. So if the banks lend out too much money, it can't pay each other back to meet their required reserve rates before closing time. And then and at this rate, the Fed can just bail them out at those cheap preferential interest rates. So a quick example of that is if a bank needs $10 billion by 5 p.m. just to cover the payroll and lending obligations and whatever it might need, then they can just get that money from the Fed. The banks can get that money from the Fed at super cheap rates to save their asses. All right. And so the amount of money the Fed can print to prevent these imbalances, again, is unlimited, unless if the people, the plebs on Main Street, start to wake up and realize, oh, we should fucking buy Bitcoin instead, because this is just some hokey pokey bullshit. So next we're gonna go to before we get into IOER and the reverse repo, we're gonna get into like Lehman a little bit, but really we're gonna, as I titled in the article, Bernanke's bailout bag. So IOER, interest on excess reserves, this tool was used by Ben Bernanke in 2008, and he was the one that really made that rate to begin with. So both policies are, as I mentioned, used to tighten or remove liquidity from the economy. And basically, when he used this IOER, banks kept tightening for years in order to sterilize or take out all of that QE money that Bernanke created in the first place to avoid hyperinflation. So the Fed, he basically had to get rid of the Fed bailout money to prevent that. So again, this is just a process of sterilization, and it was a way of using IOER. So with IOER, this means that interest on excess reserves is what that stands for. Any excess reserves in the banking system could be held at the Fed and earn interest. So if the banks are basically just like filled with cash and they lend it out, that's going to go to a limited supply of goods and services, and that's how you get hyperinflation. So to avoid that, it's basically like, it's like using BlockFi, you know? You park, I'm not saying anyone uses that, but essentially any extra cash that the banks had, they could go park that at the Fed and give, I think it was 25 basis points at the time. And so basically they couldn't get a rate like this anywhere else in the money markets, because they weren't the Fed. The money markets aren't the Fed. So the Fed was just like, yo, park all that extra cash into a bank account and you can earn interest on it, and you can prevent the economy from collapsing and hyperinflating for a while. And that's what the banks did. So obviously that dried up liquidity in the market, because the banks don't have the excess capital to make the loans. And in the past, banks didn't use IOER because what the Fed paid was usually, as I mentioned, below that going rate that was offered in the world economy. So nobody used the facility because rates were zero bound. And during Lehman, that's exactly what Bernanke did. So let me see here. So yeah, Bernanke raised rates to 25 basis points, and naturally the banks responded and responded to this new policy and parked $2.8 trillion of cash at the Fed and just earned interest on that. So if IOER is higher than what banks can make anywhere else, then they're just going to follow that pricing signal, like what Parker Lewis and others, Hayek talks about. This is essentially what the Fed is able to do with interest rates. Because as I've talked about, there's multiple rates. There's the Fed funds rate and IOER. Now we're getting again into repo rates. But all this is a fiat, like by decree, like make it so, manipulation of the pricing mechanism and the pricing signal. So that's how we understand the Fed. They just fuck with everything monetarily. All right, so now we covered IOER, we're going to get into repo. So this is just another tightening tool that the Fed utilizes. And it's basically a repurchase agreement. So it's similar to Bernanke's method of quantitative easing that he used during the Great Recession. But what I like to call this is high time preference QE, because that's what Bernanke did. He used QE, but this is high time preference QE because the repo contracts really only are, they're a short, they happen in a short time frame. Like they call it the overnight repo. And from what I've heard and seen, repo contracts aren't any longer than like 15 days. So just think of repo as high time preference QE, but a bank has a treasury and they need liquidity. So they go and park it at the Fed for a week or whatever, and they get cash back to meet their lending obligations. And then they have that sent back to them. And basically put, repo is contract that the Fed makes temporarily with those banks to help them make those lending obligations. All right. And so a reverse repo is just exactly the opposite of that. So in this scenario, the Fed sends securities or treasuries to the bank in exchange for cash. Because, again, too much cash is going to give us hyperinflation. So they send the cash to the banks and earn interest on that. And in the case of Powell, IOER and reverse repo are, again, tools to dry up liquidity in the market, and it's been 5 basis points. So that's what's been happening. Now, we're going to get into why Powell's doing what he's doing. So as I mentioned, I think earlier, this has been happening since June of 2021. And that happened at the June FOMC meeting. So FOMC is the Federal Open Market Committee, basically where Fed and all the member banks kind of release what they're going to do. Fed minutes, I mean, that's kind of where that was our source of what their plans were as far as interest rates. All right. And so like Bernanke's strategy, Powell began his process of sterilizing the markets of cash to avoid inflation. And Powell was really just doing this as a defensive strategy of tapering to remove money from the global economy. And what that's doing is putting this asymmetric pressure on Europe. And in June, with just overnight, $250 billion was moved from the markets. And that basically crashed the euro, because investment happens not just in America, obviously. And if that investment dries up, then you're kind of like tits up in your financial operations in whatever you're doing. Because again, it's all about the pricing mechanism and giving people signals to put money where it's treated best. Because ultimately, like, we all know this, capital gets treated where it's treated best. It's like water. It just like flows where it makes the most sense. And ultimately, this is what I think is going to happen with Bitcoin as rates go up. And I'll get into that a little later. But let's take a little stroll across the pond to Europe. So unlike the Fed, the European Central Bank, or the ECB, can, and most likely plans to, go bankrupt. And you can just see this, how they're just intentionally destroying the euro with things like negative interest rates. And Tom refers to this in a lot of interviews that he does. And their plan allegedly is to just wreck their sovereign bond market and dry up the banking industry. And this is all a part of, you know, the WEF, World Economic Forum, like, Great Reset. The Great Reset is Europe's Trojan horse to really gain control of the world's monetary flow by undercutting the Fed's banking cartel of the member banks. Because right now, the member banks are the ones that are able to scoop up half of the treasuries. And so that's all part of the EU's goal, is to destroy the US's ability to taper, not only just taper, but to destroy their dollar hegemony. But, you know, it's a part of their plan to really destroy their hegemony with these Build Back Better programs that would really cost America trillions. And in fact, luckily, that's not being passed, because the whole Biden Build Back Better plan that have like $5 trillion like total like spending was slapped down by a Democrat, Joe Manchin, I think it was. So this kind of goes back to like, why even like a Democrat on like Biden's chair, or a Democrat at all? Like, why would they slap that down? And this kind of goes into, you know, like Hugh Davos is. And from my knowledge, you know, Davos is majority Democrats, and even like more of the radical progressive ones, anyone that's passing these green Build Back Better sort of policies. But you can see how even within Democrats and just all over like both political spectrums, that people are not for this. They're not for Europe that destroys the way that we look at capitalism today. And again, capitalism sucks. Fuck the banks, fuck the Fed and all that. But the point I'm trying to get across here is that you just have all these different ideologues within the world that make policy that's just kind of like controls everything. It's much more nuanced than like this new world order, like government. There are people that kind of want that, and that's where I believe Davos is kind of like aligned with. But even it's like you have a battle of European globalists and American globalists, and the European globalists are Davos, and they want a EU CBDC kind of thing. And then you have basically the American globalists that want to just keep things the way they are, a Federal Reserve central banking cartel ran by none other than private equity Powell. And let's see here, almost done through here. But basically, these Build Back Better policies were designed to just make sure the Fed has no option but to monetize all that spending, all that $5 trillion, and just force negative interest rates on Americans, just like Europe's doing to its citizens. And what this would do, just, you know, destroy the dollar and strengthen the Europe, and that would just prevent Europe from imploding on its debt as the ECB implements that CBDC, like, you know, basically copying the Chinese playbook, and institute capital controls over its individuals and just have them be dependent on a euro or, you know, some sort of SDR, kind of like Hoda McGee likes to talk about. I think that's more the form that it takes, but it's kind of driven more so by Davos. So ultimately, Powell's decision to raise rates, as I mentioned, is preventing this whole thing from happening, which I see as a monetary flippening. So as far as those Build Back Better plans, we had some of those kind of passed during or after the whole COVID crash, and we saw that in the CARES Act. So with the CARES Act, now we are kind of cutting into the hegemony that the Federal Reserve banking cartel has of scooping up all those treasuries, like I mentioned, because now both corporates and non-financial corporates, so think of like BlackRock's, like, sure, they deal with money, but at the end of the day, they're not a Goldman Sachs. They're not a bank. And so people, entities like that had the same access to the Fed window that was originally exclusive to the banking cartel. And since COVID, IOER was zero, and the repo window was only available to those Federal Reserve banking cartel, like, primary dealers. And now they're being cut out of the monetary system, or they were at least. But basically, the good old boys of the banking cartel were being cut out of the system because now these Build Back Better, like CARES Act after COVID plans that were being passed out of Davos allowed non-financial corporates or just people that didn't have this privilege, like BlackRock, access to the same Fed window where they got into that 50% pool to scoop up those treasuries. And that is a direct threat to the banks, the Fed and its member banks, aka the money-making machine. So simply put, Powell is doing this tightening by increasing the rates of IOER in reverse repo markets by 5 basis points to protect the U.S. banking cartel and dollar hegemony. And the Fed's expectations of raised interest rates are, of course, only going to strengthen the dollar and crush the euro. And we keep seeing that, like, week after week. Like, I watch the market reports that Tom does, and he goes over the futures in the euro markets, and that's just another good way to see, you know, where you can see expectations in rate hikes and how many are going to happen. And in December, we even saw that the Fed signaled its willingness to just taper even more aggressively with 3 rate hikes in 2022. And this was demonstrated by a moving of, I think, $1.7 trillion. That was on December 20th. $1.7 trillion flowed into repo markets. And there are foreign repo markets as well. Like, keep that in mind. So you just had a bunch of money leave not only Europe, but now China. And you even had at the virtual Davos meeting yesterday how the Chinese were basically bitching about removal of, like, U.S. dollar liquidity from Chinese markets. So it's really kind of, like, ironic because for the short mid-term, from what I can tell and from what I've learned in just a few months, we should be bullish Powell and have a strong dollar. Because you even hear Haldon McGee argue that a strong dollar is going to ultimately a strong Bitcoin and, like, vice versa. But not only that, like, if you're fed up with fucks like Ray Dalio supporting, like, Chinese investments, this kind of stops that. If you're pro ending the Belt and Road Initiative, that kind of stops that. Because, I mean, they're not completely de-dollarizing, but China has been just selling treasuries and, like, we're just using that money instead to fund these projects. And it's drying up that market. And so basically, when the government's debt is offering you negative yields on excess euros or whatever shit coin, like, fiat currency you have, when they're offering you a yield of 5 basis points in the world's reserve currency, is pretty attractive. And so you're seeing all the sell-off in these other world currencies just for that, because, again, it all goes back to controlling the pricing mechanism and what makes the most sense. These are just world powers making the most rational economic decision, and it's kind of human action playing out. And so anyway, as deflationary pressures like this start to set in, it's going to be, there is going to be an inevitable correction, and you're just going to have all these zombie companies. I think make up like 15% of, like, the stock market. It's made up of these fucking zombie companies, like your WeWorks and whatnot, that are basically in debt to their eyeballs, and you're going to see them go tits up too. And a lot of people, I don't think, were ready for it because they did have their eyes set on, you know, that, you know, $5 trillion of spending that they were going to expect, and they thought there's no way for the market to not go up at this point. And frankly, I think they're just dead wrong, because at the end of the day, we got private equity Powell kind of running this show. That's the world that he comes from, and he's going to do everything that he can to protect the dollar. And it's kind of like a Paul Volcker 2.0 that we saw in the early 80s. And sure, does Bitcoin benefit from money printing? Hell yes. Does gold benefit from money printing? Absolutely. And we saw that happen during Vietnam and everything. And that turned around when Powell basically shot up Fed funds rate to like 20% or whatever the hell it was. And then gold tanked. Is Bitcoin going to tank? Yeah. I mean, it's already tanking, so that just means it's a fucking sale for us, right? That's called a discount. And there's an argument that it might not happen because Bitcoin is more mature and it's seen kind of as a risk-on asset. And with high rates, that's where capital flows. And high rates aren't going to last forever, of course. But, like, my question is, when rates start to turn around, whether that's in like 2025 or 2030, whatever, however long it lasts, because eventually they are going to have to like start printing more and I'm monetizing debt. But like when that turns around and you have liquidity flee from Europe and Asia and everywhere else into the US, and you have this reallocation of capital because people don't gamble on WeWorks and just zombie companies. When that happens, does Bitcoin stay a risk-on asset? Or does it change to risk-off and just become like an asset and kind of go like beyond gold? Because ultimately, sure, a strong dollar means I don't know, like at some point, I think that the chickens do come home to roost. And yeah, you got your Mark Goodwins, people that are writing articles about how Bitcoin becomes this, you know, world reserve asset. And, you know, this liquidity flight, you know, maybe people will get fed up about using the dollar because we're seeing that, as I mentioned, China, Russia, India, Iran are leaving the SWIFT system and going to transact maybe whatever virtual currency they come up with, but they very well could be settling in Bitcoin at the end of the day. And ultimately, what does this mean to Bitcoin? I think this is bullish for Bitcoin, both in the short and long term. In fact, I argue in my article that this is the way that Powell's going to Trojan horse a Bitcoin standard, intentionally or unintentionally. I don't know. I can't speak for him, but basically, this is kind of a makeshift, more sound monetary policy with these methods of drying up the world economy temporarily to strengthen the dollar. And so, again, let's go back to private equity Powell and his shareholders. Like, they might be incentivized to maintain their economic rule by embracing Bitcoin as a legitimate asset that's going to ensure dollar hegemony. And so during times of economic uncertainty, the world pulls back on liquidity and not knowing what the Fed's monetary policy is going to be. And Powell's hawkish policies are great signals to do exactly that. And the Fed needs to gain back control of the market's trust. Ultimately, I think that's what's happening. And raising rates is really the only way to do that. And this narrative that dominates market, this is the narrative that dominates market thinking. And it's exactly what was demonstrated with Powell. And so confidence in America's creditworthiness is going to wane as financial institutions become impaired once people realize the moral hazard between banks and Fed bailouts. And so decoupling is for sure going to happen in legacy financial markets and just the legacy system as people seek new collateral. Even like despite how strong the dollar is, like maybe the Ponzi can't keep going. And the more Bitcoin moves and gets on people's radar, they're going to have to, as Michael Saylor says, plug into the Bitcoin economy just to maintain relevance and to be profitable and offer solutions, Bitcoin financial solutions until, you know, the plebs and normies and no coiners wise up and want to actually take custody of their Bitcoin. And of course, not everyone's going to do that. I think there is going to be kind of like what Nick Carter talks about, this wildcat banking era 2.0, maybe, where you have Bitcoin banks and they boom and bust and whatever. But anyway, the world is going to have to plug into Bitcoin, whether they like it or not. And as Satoshi so eloquently said, the root problem with conventional currency, so all the trust that's required to make it work. The central bank must be trusted not to debase the currency, but the history of fiat currencies is full of breaches of that trust. Banks must be trusted to hold our money and transfer it electronically, but they lend it out in waves of credit bubbles with barely a fraction in reserve. We have to trust them with our privacy, trust them not to let identity thieves drain our accounts, and ultimately, we've seen that trust, you know, lose confidence in that trust. And especially with the past couple of years, normies are seeing the scales fall from their eyes and they're losing trust in these institutions because the failed policies in COVID. And ultimately, Bitcoin is the gravity that kind of ties us all back to, you know, a new building back better, a new default, a new zero. And really, I end my article by saying Powell's monetary policies of tightening to strengthen the dollar will have been the ultimate speculative attack on the dollar, whether he knows it or not, and be that Trojan horse for a new era of sound money. And the experimentation of the legacy system is going to just end as they gradually adopt Bitcoin. And it's just going to be that serendipitous process that the world needs to get on a Bitcoin standard. So, hope that didn't confuse you too much. It confused the hell out of me. This took me almost like 4 months to really just study and learn what the fuck I was going to talk about. But it really just kind of opened my eyes to there's a lot more nuance in the world than just money printer go burr. And people, it's like people had too much confidence in just how the Fed can keep printing and how they can never raise rates. Ultimately, the Fed wants to protect its ass and protect the dollar, and they're willing to let the market take a, I guess, 10% hit in the stock market in order to just maintain its hegemony, because when it's threatened, it's going to fight for its life, and that's what's happening. When does it wake up to realize that it needs Bitcoin? Or I guess when do the people savvy up to become their own banks? Who knows? And again, I could be completely wrong, and Tom Luongo says he could be wrong on this. So, not to quote Plan B, and not to compare myself to Plan B, this is just a model. But I think there's a lot more merit in how true this is going to turn out than fucking stock to flow. So, take everything that I say with a grain of salt. I'm learning in real time as I go, but that's my story so far, and I'm a lifelong learner, and I'm just going to stick to that. So, yeah, that's my shit. Questions, come on up and tear me a new asshole.
Beautiful, Phil. Love it. All right, guys. If you guys have questions, request to speak, and I'll bring you up. If not, we'll keep asking Phil some questions and keep it going. Phil, I have a comment, and then I got a question. First off, I love the podcast you did. I don't remember what episode number it was or if you put episode numbers, but Boy Named Sue with Tom Luongo, great, great podcast. You should listen to it, as well as the three episodes that you link, Phil, to Tom's podcast, Gold, Goats, and Guns, episodes 75 through 77. Highly recommend you guys all listen to that. One of the things that I really liked about that pod was how Tom was naming names and basically choosing sides. Not for us to, or not for himself to choose sides, but for us to understand who's on whose side. And one thing I came out from after listening to the podcast that Phil did, as well as Tom's personal podcast, is kind of like, I know this is going to be kind of blasphemous since it's a Bitcoin podcast, but I came out like bullish knowing that Jerome Powell is in the position he is, because before I dabbled in Phil's in this theory or this model, as you said, I was kind of taking the opposite perspective of, wow, Jerome Powell is an enemy to Bitcoin. He doesn't want to see us succeed, yada, yada, yada. He's doing things blatantly to disrupt the markets and all that good stuff we were thinking. And then after the fact, I'm like, wow, okay, the way that Tom lays this out, it seems like as an American, we
we're better off having Jerome Powell there than not. And I know a lot of Bitcoiners might read about that, but what I got from Phil, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm like, was super bullish on Jerome. I'm like, wow, all right, like, hype. At least we got someone that is willing to fight. And whether that's good or not, I don't know. It made me bullish.
And he's not fighting for Bitcoin. It's just his self-interest. He's in the business of preserving the banking network. Because if people do still rely on money printer go burr and bailouts, him and the banks are the ones responsible for that. And he's beholden to them because the banks are the shareholders of the Fed. And so, and I haven't done a deep dive on his history, but he comes from private equity, and it's basically kind of the same deal. Like, you invest in a company, and you're beholden to the board and the capital behind it. And it is really odd, but all it is like, where are the incentives? Like, show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcome, or whatever the fucking quote is. But yeah, it is really eye-opening. And this is also another reason why I don't think we'll have a top-down central bank digital currency like they want in Europe and what they have in China. Now, sure, because Powell has come out and said things like, you know, we don't need a CBDC, the Fed doesn't need to issue one, but that's what the banks are for. And sure, like, maybe they'll have more capital controls and have this, like, consumer interface kind of Fed digital dollar CBDC kind of thing, but it's like, it's just the interface and the infrastructure is built out through the commercial banks and they provide it for the consumer. And maybe the Fed is just like a dummy, like, database in the background that they like API to or some shit. But it's really, it sounds kind of silly, but I think like Americans are just too American. Even the American globalists are too American to that point. And they won't have that like top-down kind of control that the EU is or Davos is really kind of looking for. So it's wild, and this year and how this is going to play out, it's just kind of had to be sort of a wait and see, and whether or not I told you so or I was dead fucking wrong or maybe somewhere in between.
Okay, Bitcoin Bloodbath or Bob Van Kirk, you got a question?
Yeah, hey, Phil, one thing you had mentioned that I was thinking of is if inflation gets so bad, whether it's under Powell or anyone else, that I guess what do you think about the possibility that the Fed creates a CBDC that basically replaces the dollar and forces all banks and people to trade in, let's say, 10 or 15 of their existing dollars for this new CBDC, and it essentially resets everything just due to high inflation and crazy costs of everything?
Yeah, so again, I don't think that happens, because what Powell's doing is trying to cause deflation by incentivizing institutions that have excess cash to go earn yield on that at an account in the Fed. And yes, that's just creating latent inflation. But, you know, I think what you see is just a correction when interest rates start going up and then capital flees Europe and goes into the U.S. And I don't think that really causes hyperinflation, because it's just going to be that capital is going to flow into businesses that make sense and are profitable and are kind of like tried and true. And again, like the whole CBDC thing, I don't think that really aligns with the current like monetary like rule, because if there is, I don't think hyperinflation will happen, just because capital will correctly flow. And yeah, I'm kind of going in circles, but if any CBDC actually gets instituted, then again, that's kind of like a threat to the commercial banks. because it would be a top down, like the Fed is going to issue it, and that would kind of like render the commercial banks useless. And basically the Fed cannot do that because it's beholden by the demands of the member banks in its primary dealers. And I think, again, the only thing close that you get to a CBDC is just, sure, a more efficient way to get capital to those consumers. But I'm even skeptical if that happens. But again, I'm still learning about this stuff, and I know that you work in banking, so you might know a shit ton more on this than I do. So I'd actually be curious to... I don't know how much you can say or can't say, but I'm just kind of curious of like what you're looking at and what you see maybe coming down the pipeline.
Yeah, I think it's definitely hard to say. I think you got to look at things from a lot of different angles, but I do see a place where things get so far out of control that there's still a place for commercial banks, but a CBDC comes into play to basically reset everything that's transpired with inflation. Now, maybe it doesn't play out that far, but I guess I'm not ruling it out as a possibility. The other thing that when you were talking that I was thinking about that I think is an interesting thought experiment is we have, you know, banks in the U.S. are fractional, you know, in a fractional reserve system. And so since most people most people just still trust financial institutions, maybe not a lot of the people in this channel, but if people trust financial institutions and would buy Bitcoin only if their financial institution offered it, do we get into a position where we don't really get to hyper Bitcoinization very soon because most people that are going to buy Bitcoin are going to buy it through their financial institution, and these institutions that we trust don't actually hold all the Bitcoin, right? They're holding fractions.
Right. So that could definitely happen. And maybe we see kind of like prelude to like a Nick Carter, like boom and bust thing with Wildcat Banking. But I guess that's more of a tangential thing. But I think if banks actually do offer Bitcoin solutions, they're going to have to be held accountable to some extent. Otherwise, they're all going to be like Mt. Goxes. And this is, I think, where Hoddle Magoo gets his idea of, like, as institutions have to plug into Bitcoin to offer Bitcoin services, then that kind of strengthens the dollar to some extent, right? Because if people are so dependent on financial institutions, then, you know, I really don't know where this goes. Does it strengthen Bitcoin or does it strengthen the dollar or both? And I feel as the value of Bitcoin increases, it becomes the, you know, the airbag for if the dollar does hyperinflate. But again, I don't think that that would be the case because there's going to be such a demand for dollars if rates keep going up, and a strong dollar is just going to, like, you know, make the debt that much worse for everyone else that owes a dollar debt.
Hey, Phil.
I directly answered your question, but maybe you can help me out with this. Like, where do you see, like, Bitcoin succeeding or failing if banks are offering Bitcoin products?
Well, I'll say I think that there is so many opportunities. And I think the more that Bitcoin is normalized and connected with traditional finance, the better it's going to be for everybody. But, you know, I do have concerns that the large financial institutions will get to it first and that normies will end up gravitating towards the larger financial institutions, and effectively they'll have a monopoly over, you know, money movement, and community banks and credit unions will cease to exist, consolidate, those types of things. And we'll see something, you know, the aftermath will be kind of like what happened to the telecoms after the internet was introduced, and there was that consolidation, bankruptcies, capital flowing in and out of the market. So it'll be interesting, but I think it's not going to be without pain. There'll be bumps in the road. And I really do think it's important for people to consider not using, you know, the mega banks and the large banks for these services, or at least encouraging people who aren't willing to self-custody their own Bitcoin, that they trust smaller entities rather than the big ones, because it's going to mean, well, I think it's going to end in peril for a lot of us, or a lot of our friends who aren't willing to take the time to understand self-custody and how to safely, you know, hold their own Bitcoin.
Yeah, solid point.
This reminded me of the Bitcoin Talk post that Hal Finney did, that the biggest risk is probably going to be paper Bitcoin and the fractionalization of Bitcoin, and some people will get wrecked in the future. And that's
if that happens, though, even at like the JP Morgan level, like they can't get bailed out. And like at that point, do people start losing faith? And at that point, if I think if banks like everywhere start offering Bitcoin solutions, we've almost like, I don't know, can we call that like majority? Like we've adopted Bitcoin somehow. And we have to default on a Bitcoin standard. Like, I'm just spitballing right now. But if that's the case and people actually believe in Bitcoin more than fiat, even if they lost all their Bitcoin because every bank got, like, Mt. Gox themselves, it's kind of like, well, the banks don't really have anywhere else to go because they can't make a CBDC that people trust and believe in, because the one that they made on top of it broke. And so it's like, well, I'm sure maybe that you'll see like blood in the streets at that point, but it's really interesting. Like, I don't think even the Fed would have even any other option if Bitcoin was like adopted by institutions at that level.
I think what it takes is a run on a bank, and these banks are so large and hold so much capital and will eventually hold so much Bitcoin capital that it will be very difficult if we don't do a good job of educating people, or at least helping people to pay attention that the threat is there. Like, it's great that you own Bitcoin, but it's not enough that you just own it and hold it on Coinbase or on, you know, with your bank or yep. wherever. Like, you have to self-custody it, otherwise you may not actually own Bitcoin, and Bitcoin will be diluted and people won't know that they actually don't own it, they just own it on paper.
Yeah.
And so the biggest thing that the banks have is trust. But, you know, do you trust, and, you know, I work for a financial institution, but I look at it, do I trust that I can get my money out of the bank, being that they hold, you know, depending on the financial institution, 6-12% in reserves of the actual deposits that they're purported to have. And so the same thing is going to go for Bitcoin. And if more people are trusting financial institutions to hold it in custody for them, and yet the banks are treating it the same way they do now with fractional reserve, that just poses this big threat. Like, you know, the whole thing with Bitcoin is that there's only so much to go around. And so does it hold the same weight?
Yeah, but like, what's interesting is that, like, even during the GFC, like, the banks didn't trust each other. And so that's when the Fed came in and bailed them out, but that was with fiat. So if the banks don't trust each other and the people don't trust the banks, then they start to lose trust in fiat itself. And yes, there's only so much Bitcoin to be spent around, but that's the point. Because if people lose faith in fiat, then the only place to spend capital is to spend Bitcoin. So even the banks that have the most Bitcoin ever are still going to have to like spend that Bitcoin because there's only so much. And so that's kind of like, it's the same argument where some like naysayer towards Bitcoin goes, oh, well, what if the cantillion effect happens on Bitcoin? It's like, to some extent, it can, but it also can't, because people will have to spend their money eventually. I don't know, like, maybe we go beyond that. There is some, like, credit system that works. But at the end of the day, if people get goxed, I think the world gets goxed. And the banks get goxed, and the banks gox each other. And they just start losing faith in fiat. And they're kind of forced to spend Bitcoin and to cover their losses, and that kind of circulates everywhere else.
Bullish, Phil.
I don't know how the fuck that plays out.
Sounds bullish to me.
I like it. I like it, Phil. It's like, you know, when you have, you know, somebody you don't like, you just say,
fuck gun.
Yeah, like, go get goxed.
Get goxed.
Go buy some Bitcoin at that bank over there, because I really don't like the guys that work there, nor you. I hear they're fractionalizing their Bitcoin. That's definitely the place you should be buying at. We got a few good comments in our YouTube channel. First one's by our boy Zorn. He goes, Bitcoin won't be adopted like the iPhone because it's cool. It will be adopted like gunpowder. If you don't own it, you'll be its victim. A quote from Safety and Amos. Our buddy Dr. Robot, he goes, Bitcoin is not a product. It's a protocol. And we got Stuart. Do you have a question?
Stuart, what's up, man?
Hey, Phil, how's it going?
It goes, dude. Good to see you.
Yeah. Well, I guess my question, I tweeted it, but so on, this is more back to the global macro and Powell and the Fed. But if, like, I was looking at the NASDAQ, and it's already reacting negatively to the talk about the rate increases already. While Bitcoin, I mean, just going like Tuesday to today or Monday to today is up just a smidge, but it is up a little bit. It's decorrelating, deleveraging from the NASDAQ a little bit. Now it needs to continue, but also another chart that correlates to this is the 10-year bonds. The 10-year bond rates were always correlating with Bitcoin throughout 2021. Well, since January, just a few weeks, but they've decorrelated, completely deleveraged. And it's a big gap now. And it needs to mean revert back. And that would mean Bitcoin would have to pump. But for that, you know, if you like look out a little bit longer term, with the Fed, if they do like say 3 or 4 rate hikes, that gets us out to the end of the year, probably 2022. Mm-hmm. Now we're at what, 1.8% on the 10-year. How high can the 10-year bond rate go before the government can no longer fund itself? Eventually, the government will have to revert back to printing, and you know.
Yeah. Eventually.
Yeah, and now I don't know if that's mid-2022 or mid-2023. I don't think it's that long. I don't think that the Fed can afford to raise rates. I mean, they can for now, but how far can they take it until they have to go back to what they were doing last year and the year, and especially 2020 with QE, and just print just to fund the government, you know. Strictly for that reason, and to, you know, make their debts cheap, obviously, with inflation, inflate away their debt.
Yeah. So again, I think it's much different when the dollar is actually being threatened. And again, the Fed and the banks, I don't really think care as much about the market. They just care about like staying alive, and they're willing to, I guess, let the market drop like 10, 15 points, like as just a normal correction. So, you know, I don't know like too much, like how long they can go for. My feeling is that they can just like go for it as long as they really need to, because I also agree that they're going to have to like start pumping again. But, I think, I think that this looks a little different when you actually have like that reallocation of capital going into companies and investments that actually make sense. And and right now, like, prices just like don't make any sense. So again, I'm gonna be honest, like, I think this question is kind of like beyond my understanding, and I really didn't get into really looking and understanding like what treasury yields kind of like mean. Like, I understand like the more the yield on the 10-year goes up, that's kind of like a fear of inflation. But you know, it's really interesting because I think they'll go as long as they can. Like, and it's not just like this last month that people learned that they were tapering. Like, they've technically been doing this since June, and so I don't know. Like, it just seems that there's kind of like this greater geopolitical war. It's like a war of central banks, and ultimately, I think the Fed will win, especially if everybody's debt is still denominated in dollars. So I think they're willing to put up with a sick stock market for a short period to make that proper recorrection for as long as they really need to. I hope that answers some of your question.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would just add that I don't know any more than anyone else does what they're actually going to do. But if they don't reverse course and just print to fund the government, and they actually stick with rate hikes, this deleveraging crash to the stock market and real estate, it's probably going to send another wall of money or multiple walls of money into Bitcoin.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, that's like my thesis. Like, I took Tom's and then I just added more Bitcoin into it because he's not like a maxi. Like, he loves Bitcoin. But, you know, I just felt like that narrative needed something more like Bitcoin and bullish, because at the end of the day, if Bitcoin's going to be what it's going to be, it's got to get there somehow. And well, so, again, like, this whole reallocation of capital is going to be a big deal. Bitcoin's probably going to get beat up a bit more if rates keep going up. But it's ultimately going to be the thing that benefits the most. And really, I don't think we see hyperinflation because, again, that capital is we've got deflation happening, right? So I think the market is going to speak its truth and rates are going to keep going down because they're decreasing the amount of treasuries that they're buying, or at least any extra money is going to an account at the Fed and getting yield. So again, all these players, these big money players, are incentivized really to not spend and speculate as much. And that's why the zombie companies are probably going to get hit the most, undoubtedly.
Yeah. I have a suggestion. Listen to the Kitco interview. I think it was from a few days ago with Roy Niederhofer. He's the founder of Niederhofer Capital. He's a great hedge fund manager, really smart guy, really smart, and loves Bitcoin. And it's a really good interview. He talks really eloquently about my question. But again, he doesn't know. I don't know. You don't know.
Nobody.
Either way. But I.
What is it? Kitco?
Yeah, that's just the company.
With KITCO. What was his name?
His name's Roy Niederhofer. Niederhofer. Long last name. But super smart guy. And gives a really good. I mean, his thesis. They both end in Bitcoin. Or Bitcoinization, if you want to say that. But so either way, whether we deflate the stock market, real estate, by raising rates continually for a long time, that's the wall of money goes to Bitcoin. If they reverse course QE, you know, to fund the government, I mean, that might even be better. I don't know which way, but for Bitcoin. But either way, it ends in Bitcoin pumping.
Bitcoin wins either way.
Yeah,
well,
it wins. It points to Bitcoin.
If I may, real quick, you know, share like a thought, perhaps a little bit of a kindergarten thought. You know, this is going to sound crazy probably in all this, but like You know, I think that we've really entered like a serious, you know, regardless of interest rates, regardless of what happens in the world. I mean, unless there's a massive fucking solar storm and it, you know, blah, 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 fucks up everything. But overall, like, I think Bitcoin's entered like more of a like a mega cycle, you know? And I've said this since, you know, before it went up from, you know, 6K to, you know, what it, you know, the all-time high, like 69 or whatever it is, that, and it, you know, we've went down from, you know, from that high down to 32 or I guess it was 29 or something, right? And, you know, it's more of like a mega cycle. And regardless of what happens, there's still going to be major adoption, major influencer, not just influencers, but like individuals that, you know, just like El Salvador and numerous different, you know, countries eventually, you know, whether it's in the next few months or I think it'll be in the next few months, especially with like what what's happening with like Biden and, you know, all of these other countries like Russia and, you know, Ukraine and all these things. Like there's so many things happening that you have to take into account.
That's how deep, sorry to interrupt, but like that's how deep Tom gets into this shit. Like, not to be a shield for Tom, but like when he does these market reports, and sure he does like a little bit of TA, but like the TA is the glue that like wraps it all together. And you can pick some of this up like on his like free blog that he does, and he goes on podcasts on a Monday and Tuesday and does like live streams and stuff. But there are so many factors at play. I just wanted to, sorry, keep talking.
And like, I really feel like, you know, that, you know, we're, you know, beyond just like, you know, this is just, you know, it's just the same as like going from fucking 10K to 6K, you know, but it's a different cycle. You know, it's a bit longer play out of, you know, a few months and, you know, it's gonna, you know, I get, you know, it's really all, you know, making known the unknown in big ways, in my opinion as well. You know, like it could easily, you know, who know, you know, nobody really knows entirely, but I really feel like my intuition and remote view or whatever that, you know, things are, you know, this is just another, you know, micro, not just micro, but it's another just cycle of moving up and down 10-20K. You know, it's going to be the common thing with Bitcoin in the future that, you know, it's the way the market is, and it's, you know, going to keep doing it. And, you know, those that really, you know how to move, you know, how to
physical.
Sorry, dude, I had to mute you. Try to not say, you know, so much. I have
a question for physical. How many Natty Lights have you had tonight?
I've had four big waves, you know, Kona Brewing beers, and I just had a fantastic shower, and I'm ready to, you know, get a little freaky, you know what I mean? I'm all cleaned up.
Give me 1 second. When this is over, we... dollar means a strong Bitcoin, and I think my thinking is all confused on this because I've been kind of taking the thesis that like a weaker dollar makes Bitcoin better. So where's my thinking wrong, and like what am I missing right here, Phil?
Yeah, well, this goes back to like, does inflation help Bitcoin? Yeah. Does deflation help Bitcoin? Because Bitcoin goes from like a risk on asset to like a less risky asset, because the more that people buy it, the more they realize it's legitimacy, then yeah. So again, strong strong or weak dollar benefits Bitcoin.
Okay.
That makes sense. Question is like how and like what factors play in and like the time frame, I guess. Because like writing this article just forced me to just think outside and inside the box at the same time. And I don't know. Yeah, I think you can just like get too lost in this. And even this article, maybe this article is just a distraction to someone and someone doesn't give a shit and they're just bullish on Bitcoin because it's going to win anyway. Fair enough. But I think it's important to also take into consideration the outside factors and the minutiae of everything. Man, minutiae is the word of the day or the word of the podcast, I think. And ultimately, I said ultimately like seven times. But it's just fun to try to guess what's going to happen next. And it goes like kind of beyond speculation because when you look at the geopolitical puzzle pieces, you can kind of, I guess at least what Tom tries to do is look back at history and just try to guess what's going to happen based on the treaties and arrangements and relationships with all these other nations and what's happened before them. You know, that's why he calls Jerome Powell Paul Volcker 2.0. And so
there's Tom.
But it rhymes.
There's some homework for you. Physical, look in the nest and look for Phil's article at Bitcoin Magazine.
Oh, okay. All right, my bad.
There's homework assignment.
My bad. I knew that was gonna happen,
To add to Phil's point, I'm today was the first day I have heard Tom's podcast, and I'm really impressed and a fan of it. The couple episodes that I heard, I really like how he does it. He's well more informed than I am on basically everything. So it was good to get schooled.
Just a little background info. He's been doing this for years, like writing about geopolitics. He's a big Austrian. And so he writes, I think he's written on antiwar.com, lewrockwell.com, a bunch of other places. And this is his shit, dude. Like, it's kind of like pre-Bitcoin, or I guess even like the Austrian school, or like Goldbug or sound moneyness. It kind of forces you to be a Renaissance man. At least Bitcoin kind of takes that to the next level because it might make you question how like the internet works and all like the tech stuff behind it. But yeah, Tom's legit.
He claims I'm not on the show.
Written the first article on Bitcoin in 2010 on lewrockwell.com. I'm not quite sure if that's legit or not, but yeah, he really knows his stuff. It's kind of cool because he's the center point of my understanding of like Austrian economics and foreign policy. Because I came to Bitcoin through libertarianism, and it was really Dave Smith's show that kind of like made me who I am now. And I got into Rothbard, and because, you know, he would throw out names like that. And Scott Horton, who wrote the time to Fool's Errand, Time the War in Afghanistan, and Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism. That's where I kind of like got my first toes dipped into foreign policy. And then it wasn't until I got into Bitcoin where I really started studying the history of money and how it works. And then after the crash of 2020, I was like, okay, I really need to try to like grok how the financial plumbing and all this shit really works. And then Tom just kind of like re-entered my life in a way. And he was kind of like the center point that kind of like brought all the things I loved into like one. And plus, I'm a musician, and he plays bass too. So I'm like, "Fuck yes!" instant patron on Patreon.
Yeah, well, kudos to you, Phil, because like if you could orange pill him and turn him full Bitcoin maxi, like that would be that. I think that'd be a beautiful fit.
I think he's good where he's at, and he understands the thesis of it. And I don't even know if I'm like a Bitcoin like maxi, like I know I'm gonna make people piss their pants and re
Phil's a shit confirmed.
I'm a shit coiner for sure, but I think the way he kind of stands on it and well, I don't know. I don't want to say that there's like hope there, that there's no hope for him. I've heard him say things like, if Bitcoin fails, we can just go to something else. That something else is going to be Bitcoin, but like hard fork of it. But he also he's done TA in the past, and he just thinks some of these other things are interesting in the sense where, you know, maybe you can use it as a derivative, like pair to trade against it. I think there are some ways to for him to go about like the fundamentals of like why Bitcoin and like the history and like the cypherpunk mailing list and that kind of stuff. But, you know, we live in a fiat world and there's only so much time that we have. And this dude's so fucking busy. Like the amount that he writes on what's happening in Europe and Asia and the macro and all that. Like, I think like he'll probably see the light of Bitcoin at the end of some tunnel eventually. But even amongst like freedom lovers, like Bitcoin's still hard. Not everyone gets it right away.
Beautiful, Phil. All right. Well, Phil, what do you, since you told us all this, like, what are you going to be looking out for to round out this year? And what would validate your
thesis? Trying to give me price speculations?
I'm not asking you when moon, Phil. I'm asking you, like, what are you, you know, like, what indicators are you looking at now with this new understanding? You've been doing your homework. You studied up on all this. Like, what are you going to be looking out from here on to, you know, the infinite future, whatever, like what signals are you looking for to either prove your case or, you know, realize that you're wrong?
I think it proves itself. If the Fed doesn't continue raising rates, and I think even before the FOMC meeting a couple of weeks ago, there was something on Zero Hedge or they reposted something that both JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs actually predicted like a total of 7 rate hikes between now and I think 2023. And if someone as serious like that comes out and says that, then I think it should be taken seriously, or, you know, as far as what I've heard Tom here. But it's funny because he'll say that anything that Goldman Sachs comes out with, like, you should tread against them because they're fucking liars. But the fact that someone like Goldman is actually saying, yep, there's going to be a raise in rates, then you should take them seriously, because again, they're some of the primary dealers and shareholders of the Fed. And so it all goes back to like, what is their incentive? So I think that rates are going to keep going up and we're going to see a correction somehow, whatever the hell that means, however that looks. I don't know. Again, I'm just learning in real time right now. And it's going to be interesting. Some things to look out for are just, what are these increasing rates going to do around the world? Where is that capital going to shift? And I'm legitimately just asking these questions because I'd like to know. And I'd like to know if they actually do shift into Bitcoin eventually after Bitcoin maybe takes a beating, and how fast that capital flows. And also, going to just strictly like what Bitcoin's going to do, you hear about all this like private equity or just, you know, smart money, quote unquote, in these financial institutions, like a lot of them, I guess, slowly, maybe Bloodbeck can correct me on this, but there's a lot of like big money slowly that's been moving into Bitcoin. And how much is that, and how much is it going to affect the price, and when? And a lot of that money is also going into mining. And it's just kind of like a heyday for anyone who's a Bitcoin miner. And so how much is hash power going to increase even more since the drop that we had? And, you know, Bitcoin, the supply is fucking dwindling. Like, we're over 90% of the issuance now, right? So supply and demand is going to be really interesting. I can't say when, and I don't want to. But, yeah, the way that this year plays out, it's going to be crazy. I mean, Tom says, the way that financial markets and the way that we understand capitalism, at the rate that this is going, if the Fed keeps increasing rates, it could turn the way that we understand the financial world completely upside down. and the world could look completely different. And the world could look completely different in regards to not even economic impact, but social impact. People are calling bullshit on COVID. And, like, do we see secession? I don't even know. But people are waking up and they're tired of being lied to. And so, again, there's a lot of nuance. It's not just the economics. But at the end of the day, the money's fucked. And when you fix the money, you fix the world. And I think we're just, as we have been the last 13 years, we're witnessing the process of the money being fixed. And I think that's just going to start getting cranked up to 11 within this year.
Wow, Phil. Well, beautiful stuff, bro. Slightly terrifying, but also very bullish, low-key, I guess? Question mark? Phil.
Elves, buy Bitcoin.
Exactly. Phil, plug your websites and your...
Your came back up.
I just had a question that dovetailed off what you were saying, Phil. Like, stagflation. So... I don't know. I don't read as much about that stagflation, but like if we keep raising rates next year, like into next year, I forget who you said was talking about that. It 7 rate hikes. Oh, it was JP Morgan, Jamie Dimon. But if that happens, like would that, I mean, I think the stock market would be a shadow of where it is right now.
Yeah, but you have to also consider as not only like the Fed funds rate, not only if that's going up, but interest on excess reserves and reverse repo. Basically, any extra cash people have aren't going to spend that in Europe. They're going to like sell out their euro and buy dollars and move those dollars into the U.S. because the dollar's getting stronger and that's where their money's going to be treated best. And so I think maybe that's one of the buffers or the hedges to preventing like stagflation or hyperinflation, because people aren't going to spend their money and investments on fucking like AMC or like whatever. I think there's going to be less speculation and more sincere, earnest investment in things that make sense. And that capital might prevent the stagflation from happening, because capital is going to be in the right position and there's going to be plenty of capital and investment to create more jobs that actually are going to provide need in an economy, and they're going to hire the right skillful people that they need to keep that going. So maybe that's a buffer, but again, maybe the opposite does happen. Again, like I'm learning this in real time, but I think that capital flight is going to mean a lot.
Yeah. Agreed. And I don't know as much about the difference between stagflation and hyperinflation. I kind of thought more like what Japan did. That was stagflation.
Yeah. Well, like stagflation
is not as bad as Weimar.
It happens, but wages don't go up. Yeah. Or not hyperinflation, but there's inflation, wages don't go up. So that's what happened in the 70s, right? And then hyperinflation is just, I guess, like technically just hyperinflation, but it's at like 1,000% or whatever the fucking technical definition of hyperinflation is. I think just being the US, there is no hyperinflation occurrence, at least maybe not like decades later.
It'll be a combination of any of these scenarios, but they still lead to Bitcoin. So that's the bottom line.
All right, Phil. Well, plug all your wares, bro. Where can people find you? What your websites, all that stuff. And we'll wrap this one up and we'll start shitposting after.
My malwares, my underwears. I'm a commando maximalist. Okay, no, but in all seriousness, if you enjoyed the conversation and my ranting and banter, then check the nest or just DM me, but my link on Bitcoin Magazine is called, oh my god, it's so late. What the fuck did I call it? Why Jerome Powell's policies are bullish for Bitcoin. So give that a read and check out my podcast. It's called A Boy Named Sue. Sue is spelled P-S-E-U, like my Twitter handle, Mr. Sue, R-P-S-E-U, no space or period in between Mr. and Sue. So that's where you can find me on all the places. And yeah, rate, subscribe, review. If you like my podcast, I just had Laser Hoddle on last week. First Live Spaces interview thing. That was cool. So give that a 5-star review and a nice rating. And first and foremost, before Bitcoin, I was a musician, rock and roller, still am. Because of fiat life and not having a band, I don't really have time. And I only write songs when I'm inspired, like after the crash of 2020. And so I write things like End the Fed or ETF, and that's my pinned tweet. But that's only the first, like, 2 minutes of the video. So you can watch the entire thing if you open that thing up. Or go to ETF615.com and or just search, like, Mr. Sue on Spotify. Listen to the song there. And, yeah, if you want to support me, you can pay me Bitcoin. My Telegram is the same. It's Mr. Sue. ETF615. I can't remember if I renewed that domain address or not. So if I didn't, and you want to send me money, just send me a DM, and we'll work it out. Because, yeah, money makes people happy. But also, Bitcoin makes me happy, which is money. But also, all these great people I met on Twitter that give me the time of day to rant about this shit and actually give me the time to DM them and bother them, ask them questions, and just the magical relationships I made with fellow Bitcoiners has also been amazing. So, yeah, Bitcoin's the gift that keeps on giving.
Phil, that might have been the best end of show shill we've had on here. 135 episodes. So kudos to you, Phil. You know you always can come back here.